Nice. I read this, I guess, also like a year and a half ago, probably at this point. So I'm a little, it's a little rusty, but I remember the big stuff. Mostly this is, or I guess, what caught your eye from this piece, Julian?
Jeez. Dropping right into it. I really like the fact that this was a very grounded. Well, maybe we should talk about first talk about what this piece is. Like
Yeah.
what so maybe I could give my perspective and then you could give your perspective and then we could have a little
For sure.
amalgamation of the two.
Amalgamation station.
So to sum this up into very way too few words, Watts in this piece kind of talks about the Genesis creation story as well as a Anishinaabe. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Anishinaabe, as well as Haudenosaunee, creation story, and kind of compares the two and talks about the. Oh, here I'm bringing a 5-cent word into a 3-cent brain, but talking about how these different origin stories plays out into like. Have you talked about ontologies on this show yet?
We have not, but I have some definitions for us. Ontology, for those of you who do not know, is kind of the study of the nature of being, like how we are, why we are. Continue.
But yeah, perfect. Talking about how these creation stories plays out onto both Western and indigenous ontologies currently, and how the like after effects of these creation stories and how like people think and live and exist out in the world nowadays. And that's yeah, I think that's my summary of it.
Yeah,
But
for sure.
there's it goes into very good depth, brings up some very interesting points that we will hopefully talk about in a sec. But yeah, Caitlin,
Yeah,
take it away.
for sure. I feel like I love this piece. I found it super fascinating, and I tell people about it all the time. A part that I found super interesting was this idea of the epistemological ontological divide. So, as we just said, ontology is the nature of being, and epistemology is the origin of knowledge. So, how this plays out is Watts describes how in Western culture there is an epistemological ontological divide. So, our knowledge that we have in all of the ways that we think, we see it as separate from the way that we are. Essentially, yeah, we're able to hold those as two separate things in the way that both our language works, how we view things, our perspectives, etc. All of that is conducive to the idea of that being a divide. She contrasts this with some more indigenous perspectives of that divide not existing, whereas like who you are, your nature of being is not separated from the origin of your knowledge. And I found that to be super impactful. And part of why that's super impactful is when you look at how the way that you are, your nature of being is based off of a lot of things. And I think this is when she ties it to place thought. So place thought is a,
I
this is
love
the one
place
that
thought.
here, right, you describe place thought because I feel like I can't do that justice right now.
Oh, well, I might back up a little bit and talk about my first kind of like I want to give this a little bit of time because it does play out a little bit in this piece and I really like this concept. But in human geography in my first year, we talked a little about one of the ideas that got floated around is like you have both in this life, you have both physical space, like the recording studio we're in right now, the university that we're in right now, as well as cognitive space. And these two things are both like they're separate from one another. And like the best example I ever heard about, I heard of this is that you can be in a library, but there's also the idea of the library that you're in at the same time. That you know that in this space, things are quiet, you learn about things, knowledge is given and taken. But so it's much more than just a like a physical manifestation. That's, I think, a very Western perspective. And then on the indigenous perspective, you have place thought, which takes this, I feel like, 100 steps further.
Before you do
One
that,
hundred percent.
by Western, when we say like this is a Western ideal, essentially that is referring to all of like the Western European and American, like North American kind of ideals and ways that that affects a lot of thinking. This is also heard under the name of the North Atlantic. And basically, this is used a lot in like different academic spheres to kind of describe a set of ideas that is very consistent amongst a lot of those areas. You see this like around like capitalism, democracy, a lot of the similarities are kind of Western ideals mm-hmm. that are very frequently taken for granted as something that is much more universal than it is, seeing that it is that the West, so again, like Europe and North America a little bit, is not the whole world and not representative in any way of the whole world. So that's what we mean by that.
And like maybe even to draw that into our point, like not into our point, but into this piece, Western often implies having a Christian background,
mm-hmm.
having semi-capitalist or full-on capitalist kind of economic and social systems. And in terms of place thought, then, so we've talked about cognitive space being a mental space, then a place thought takes that further and implies that the space that you are inhabiting, the objects and the animals and the plants and whatnot have a sense of agency in it, bringing this back to where what we were talking mm-hmm. about at the beginning of the show. And like not just agency as a word, but as a like a full-on practice, as a way of knowing and understanding the place in which you're sitting.
Yeah. An example of this that could make this make sense for people is think about language, right? In some languages, we have words for some things, and in other languages, we don't have that word. I think of it kind of specifically around, like, random, like, outdoor sports, where, like, there are things that you can do in some areas that you can't. I think in Spanish, like, to go rafting is, like, hacer rafting, which is, like, to do rafting, but, like, with the English word.
Mm-hmm.
At least that is, like, how I've learned it. But, like, just because that word doesn't exist in the same way
mm-hmm.
Is an example of how that can manifest itself if you're looking for more tangible thing. But continue, generally.
Here's a question. Have you heard of, in this piece, Watts brings up the example of the three sisters. Do you know, have you ever heard about, the three, in terms of crops? The three sisters.
What is it? It's corn, potatoes, and
almost corn, beans, and squash.
Yeah.
And something I feel like that really hits this nail on the head is like colonizers kind of took this idea and they westernized it a little bit, and that's why like I grew up knowing about this a little bit, but like from an indigenous perspective, Watts talks about the fact that this is more so than just a symbiotic relationship between these three things, like the beans giving the nitrogen to the soil, the squash providing the shade, and the corn offering a lattice for the beans to work their way up. From an indigenous perspective, it's more than that. It's a relationship between these three plants, mm-hmm. an agreeance to live in harmony with one another.
Which is then pointing back to what we were talking about earlier with like the mushrooms and the agency and the social. Basically, all of this is to say that I feel like a very underlying theme of this episode is that sociology is really cool for describing human social relationships, mm-hmm. but can very easily be extended into the natural. And I have found that so cool. That was not something that I knew before taking like my sociology and anthropology courses, so finding that out, I was mind blown.
That's total kind of cool, world shift. From like an indigenous perspective, there is no difference between the two. There is no human and natural.
There is no super cut. Interesting. But yeah, so place thought, I'm trying to figure out if we touched all of our important points. Do you have anything else to say about Watts?
Oh, shoot.
I mean,
well, one of the kind of tangents I could go down a little bit,
free.
Which one of the things I really appreciate about this reading is it talks about the difference between origin stories between, word Western, the W word, Western and indigenous origin stories.
Can you give a little overview of those stories and then?
Again, I feel the need to position myself. I'm going to try my best. Like, this is a very gross amalgamation of many, many, many individual origin stories. And Watts, I think, gives the Haudenosaunee version of this, but I'm assuming that a lot of the listeners know a little bit about the Christian origin story of Adam and Eve and Genesis. Is that a gross assumption to make?
I mean, yeah, maybe give it like a little slight overview because I don't actually remember what Genesis is.
So, again, I haven't picked up a Bible in forever. I'm not Christian myself. But in the Christian telling of the origin of the world, God made the world in 6 days. I'm absolutely going to get flopped.
And rested on the seventh.
And rested on the seventh. And during this time, he made the world, he made light, and he made sun, and he also made Adam and Eve to populate it. One thing leads to another. A serpent gives Eve some bit of knowledge, tells her about this tree wherein she will learn everything about the world. Eve goes and, I think, convinces Adam.
There's an apple that's eaten. Eve eats the apple.
And thus humanity is struck out of the Garden of Eden.
Yeah.
That is probably a butchering of the... There's probably a lot of Christians listening in that are willing to slap me for that. But that's my best... That's the agnostic's perspective on on the Christian origin story. Hopefully I won't do as bad a job on the indigenous side. But on the indigenous side... Sky Woman exists on this earth, but at first there is only water. There is no land. Actually, I'm forgetting this, but I feel kind of at a loss describing this, so I might just bring out the key elements at the very end. By the end of the story, Sky Woman is given a place to live on the back of a turtle. I think I might be going out on a limb, but I think that's why, from an indigenous perspective, it's not called Canada or North America. It's called Turtle Island.
Yeah.
So from this perspective, there is a greater natural force that it gives home to humanity for Sky Woman to live on.
No, all good. And again, if you want the full story, this article that we're using with is called Indigenous Place Thought and Agency Amongst Humans and Non-Humans, First Woman and Sky Woman Go on a European Tour by Vanessa Watts. Very good. Do read.
But the kind of tangent I wanted to go down, which isn't going to be too long, but the distinction is that Watts makes between the two is that from the Western point of view, from the Christian point of view, humanity is struck out of a place of absolute nature because of their intelligence, because they strive to know more about the world. And thus, they are made separate from the natural world. It is humanity and there is nature. And from the indigenous perspective, humanity is brought to survive because of nature. It is through a majesty of this magnificent turtle that people can continue to live. That they have somewhere to hunt, to feed, to harvest. All these things come from a very natural perspective. I found that like really kind of put me at a bit of an awe. In so much that I feel like kind of what we were talking about before with that idea that you're mentioning before about the difference between like the you that thinks and the you in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that comes from a very Christian point of view, that these two things are separate.
For sure.
Whereas from an indigenous point of view, I feel like there is a lot less of that separateness. It is just you in total.
For sure.
That is my tangent.
I love it. So I'm going to play another song. This is called Three Floors, Three Doors by Abby Sage. And then we'll come back to you with some more thoughts.
Decided if I take a tour. I'm Dr. Anthony Leiserwitz, and this is Climate Connections. If you want to reduce your impact on climate change, you can start by thinking about what's for dinner.
And it turns out there's a lot we can do in the kitchen.
That's Chef Kathy Caton-Grazzini. She says the biggest step people can take is to eat less meat, because producing it creates a lot of planet-warming pollution. So her new cookbook, Love the Foods That Love the Planet, includes dozens of vegetarian recipes, like arugula pesto, eggplant zucchini torte, and beet burgers. But even vegetarian ingredients have some impact on the climate. So the book includes a breakdown of the carbon pollution associated with key ingredients, and it explains where those emissions come from, whether it's farming, processing, or transport.
What's really driving emissions? Is it deforestation? Is it agricultural inputs like fertilizer or irrigation?
For some ingredients, like cocoa, the way they're produced matters a lot. So the book helps people learn how to identify more sustainably produced options.
So they can make smart decisions, informed decisions about the food we eat.
She hopes the book helps people better understand the impact their food choices have on the climate and inspires them to make wonderful meals that are better for the planet.
It's a delicious way to really make a difference.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
And we're back. Thank you for listening to CJSF. This is Sociologic. I'm Kaylin.
And I'm Julian.
And we are talking to you today about the Anthropocene, the geological epoch, or the idea of a geological epoch proposed by social scientists describing the geological epoch that we're in right now, which is like an era of humans having a geological impact on the world through all of the environmental impacts we've had, and et cetera, et cetera. We've talked a little bit about Vanessa Watt's piece, Indigenous Place, Thought and Agency Amongst Humans and Non-Humans. We've talked about agency. We've talked about epistemological, ontological divides, place thought, interspecies interactions. Basically, all of this coming into the idea that sociology and social sciences in general have the means to analyze non-humans as well as humans, because there are very social interactions happening. The next thing I kind of want to talk about is this was also Anna Singh, one of those people in that mushroom research group. There is this website online that I highly suggest you go take a look at. It's called the Feral Atlas. The Feral Atlas is this really cool website. It takes a second to load on your computer, but once you have it, it's really cool. You'll open up to this screen, and you'll have to say enter. What it is a bunch of research and examples describing how humans have impacted the world and vice versa. So one example that there is on fire. And also it's shows there's art, there's poetry, there's different research that's been done. It's super duper cool. And when I saw this, my professor in my anthropology class last term just came and was like, hey, you guys, we're going to look at this for like the next 20 minutes and tell me what you think. And it's fascinating. Essentially, what it is trying to show in a very cool visual format is how humans are affecting the world and vice versa. So one example of this is through fire and how forest fires are not a new thing, right? But if you're living in the Pacific Northwest, you've definitely noticed in the past handful of years how intense they've gotten. And a reason for this is because of the human production of fossil fuels and the increase of that in our atmosphere and how that has affected the warming temperatures and drying out of the trees, et cetera, et cetera. Our friend Lewis is a forest fighter up in the Yukon, and he would have a lot more to say on this point. But essentially what this example is showing is how our impact on the environment is having a very real impact on this natural process in terms of forest fires, which are getting bigger and crazier every year, as we've seen. I'm just scrolling through because you can open this thing in a table where there's a bunch of different things of invasion, empire, capital, acceleration, crowd, take, grid, dump, smooth speed, burn, pipe. Those all sound like really weird words, but it makes sense. It's really, really cool. Jillian, have you ever seen this before?
No, I'm looking at it right now for the first time. This is really cool.
Again, this is called the Feral Atlas. So as long as you're not driving, you should take a look at it.
So it almost looks like a recipe for the end of the world, like all these things put together. Like I'm reading something like kudzu, jellyfish polyps, stream pollution, styrofoam. I don't know. I hope I'm talking to the mic. This is very interesting. I was looking at a picture before that was showing many of the like human impacts on this planet, showing like hunting, slavery. If you ever were at a loss for how we're impacting the globe, so it would not be a bad place to start.
Another example that's on here is like the sound of ships underwater, because all of our ships make a lot of noise in our harbors, and that's very visible in the animals that are still willing to live there and who are not willing to live there anymore.
Out of curiosity, I hope I'm not, like, with the time we have left, a question that's coming to mind is, how often do you deal with that kind of that idea of negative human impacts on the globe through sociology?
I'd say, like, a decent bit. We talk about it. I mean, it comes into discussion, right? Because a lot of my classes are very discussion-based, so people are pulling from the things that they're experiencing, and we're all living in this world that is having a lot of things go on environmentally. I would say it's like it factors into a lot of discussions we have, but it's not always the base. But it is discussed in the base, kind of like I was saying, we have our weeks where we talk about the more natural stuff. So that's just another plug of another website. What were you saying?
Oh, no, I just care, like with REM, it's every day we deal with.
Yeah.
And I was like curious how in other like social systems, it's not social systems, but what do you call it?
Classes,
yes. Thank you.
Yeah. But yeah, so I think before I get us to some music to finish off this day, I'd just like to remind you of a couple of the things we've talked about, some things to go look at. So that website we were just talking about is called the Feral Atlas. Take a look at Anna Singh and Michael Hathaway. They both talk about the mushrooms. I think Anna Singh's book is called The Mushrooms at the End of the World, and Michael Hathaway's book also has mushroom in the title, and I'm completely blanking on it right now. And then there's Vanessa Watts's Indigenous Place Thought and Agency Amongst Humans and Non-Humans. This is all super interesting stuff that we've been listening to. Oh, also that last song we were listening to is Three Doors, Three Floors by Anna Sage, I believe. I said that name wrong. So thank you so much, Julian, for coming on. Next week, I will not be here, and neither will Julian, but Rebecca will be back. And so I know she has some great stuff in store for you. Thank you so much for listening to Sociologic. Julian, do you have anything to say before we finish with some music?
Nothing much. Go out, touch some ferns.
Touch some ferns. Go touch grass. go talk to a tree or something.
Go hug a tree.
So to finish this off, we're going to listen to Mountain Man by Liz Cooper and the Stampede. Thank you so much. Have a good day, y'all. Just me.